Okay, hello internet family. This is Anjanette Potter, also known as Adams Rib, and you are listening to the Smart Black Girl Podcast. So today, in keeping with the whole Tyre Nichols situation, like I said, as I promised, in honor of making Black History something that gets taught year-round, I decided to do 11 months of Black History. And that's going to be on all of my blogs. You know, I have 14. All of my podcasts, everything is going to be dedicated to Black History. And it's going to be in keeping with the theme of each blog as well. So today, as I promised, my first topic that I was going to talk about, I wasn't just going to talk about notables, that I'm going to talk about topics that are pertain to the Black community, and you know, stuff that really is still around even after like hundreds of years of being around. So in keeping with the whole theme behind the Tyre Nichols murder, I'm going to talk about police brutality. I'm going to talk The main topic is police brutality, but there are going to be several other subtopics that are going to come under this. So police brutality is the excessive and unwarranted use of force by law enforcement against an individual or group. It is an extreme form of police misconduct and is a civil rights violation. Police brutality includes, but is not limited to, asphyxiation, beatings, shootings, improper takedowns, and unwarranted use of tasers. So now we're going to get into some history. The origin of modern policing can be traced back to the 18th century in France. By the 19th and 20th century, many nations had established modern police departments. Early records suggest that labor strikes were the first large-scale incidents of police brutality in the United States, including events like the Great Railroad Strike of 1877, the Pullman Strike of 1894, the 1912 Lawrence Textile Strike, the Ludlow Massacre of 1914, the Great Steel Strike of 1919, and the Hannah Peep Massacre of 1924. The term police brutality was first used in Britain in the mid-19th century by the Puppet Show magazine, a short-lived rival to Punch magazine. So if you're, you know, British, you've heard of Punch. I've heard of Punch. In September of 1848, when they rode scarcely a week passes without their committing some offense, which disgusts everybody but the magistrates. Boys are bruised by their ferocity, women insulted by their ruffianism, and that which brutality has done, perjury denies, magisterial stupidity suffers to go unpunished. Let me see here. And police brutality is becoming one of our venerated institutions. The first use of the term in the American press was in 1872 when the Chicago Tribune reported the beating of a civilian who was under arrest at the Harrison Street Police Station. In the United States, it is common for marginalized groups to perceive the police as oppressors rather than protectors or enforcers of the law due to the statistically disproportionate number of minority incarcerations. So Hubert G. Locke wrote, when used in print, or as the battle cry in a Black Power rally, and I'm going to talk about Black Power. So Black Power is a political slogan and a name that is given to various associated ideologies which aimed to achieve self-determination for Black people. Okay, and I'll be talking about that. Most people tend to associate Black Power with the Black Panthers, but when I talk about Black Power, you're going to see that there are many different stances. And Black Power was kind of one of many things that fell under the Civil Rights Movement. So police brutality can by implication cover several practices, from calling a citizen by his or her first name to death by a policeman's bullet. What the average citizen thinks of when he hears the term, however, is something midway between these two occurrences, something more akin to what the police profession knows as alley court. The wanton, vicious beating of a person in custody, usually while handcuffed, and usually while taking place somewhere between the scene of the arrest and the station house. Sometimes riots, for example, the 1992 Los Angeles riots are reaction to police brutality. Now we're going to go into causes. The persistence of police brutality in many nations can be linked to a collective failure of the criminal justice system. Governments are enacting hard on crime policies, poor police training, and a lack of legal repercussions for officers who use excessive force against civilians all increase the likelihood of police brutality occurring. Additionally, social issues like racial discrimination and poverty can exacerbate the brutality and its effects on marginalized communities. They discuss hard on drug campaigns. So if you remember when the cops that murdered Tyre Nichols were a part of a special police, they were called the Scorpion Squad, and they were, kind of known for hassling, minorities, especially minority men. And I remember hearing in Columbus, they had a thing called Operation Ace. And it was kind of that same thing, although nobody was murdered mercifully. But it was more or less a thing of they weren't going by the strict rules that seemed to govern other cops. So pretty much anybody that looked suspicious, they were able to stop them. And, we also have heard of stuff like stop and frisk. But basically what those things do is they're less rigid and have less rules than the average beat cop has when they stop you. And so it becomes a thing of, we called it back then, a war on Black people, because they seem to center all of their energy on Black neighborhood, largely predominantly Black neighborhoods, and what most people would call the hood. So, hard on drug campaigns are a contributor. And nations with a reputation for having a high number of drug-related issues, including gang violence, drug trafficking, and overdose deaths, one common solution that government will enact is a collective campaign against drugs that spans the entirety of the state's establishments. Changes to address these issues. Okay, sorry, my lips are a little dry. Changes to address these issues encompass education, bureaucracy, and most notably law enforcement policy and tactics. Law enforcement agencies expand and receive more funding to attack drug problems in communities. Acceptance of harsher policing tactics, as I said earlier, grows as well. And any means necessary philosophy develops within the law enforcement community. and the militarization of local law enforcement sources. However, many studies have concluded that these efforts are in vain, as the drug market has grown in such nations despite anti-drug policies. Well, one of the reasons why they continue to grow is because if you go to the street dealer, you're going to the guy who's the bottom of the barrel. Like, they're only going so high up. And most people who are over the drug trade have a hierarchy. And, you know, once that street dealer or the crack house or whatever gets busted, they just pop up in another area close to that area. So, the street dealer isn't the one that's bringing the stuff in. Okay, there's a hierarchy there. And they're not really dealing, you know, it's like putting a Band-Aid. You know, it's a Band-Aid, and it's a very bad Band-Aid. So, for example, in the United States, critics of the war on drugs waged by the government have been very vocal about the ineffectiveness of the policy, citing an increase in drug-related crimes and overdoses since President Nixon first introduced this policy. The legal system, a type of government failure that can result in the normalization of police brutality, is a lack of accountability and repercussions for officers that mistreat civilians. While it is currently commonplace for civilians to hold officers accountable by recording them, the actual responsibility of police oversight rests heavily on the criminal justice system of a given nation, as police represent the enforcement of the law. One method of increasing police accountability has become more common is the employment of body cameras as a part of police uniforms. However, the effectiveness of body cams has been called into question due to the lack of transparency shown in police brutality cases where the footage is withheld from the public. In many cases of police brutality, the criminal justice system has no policy in place to condemn or prohibit police brutality. Certain nations have laws that permit lawful violent treatment of civilians, like qualified immunity, which protects officers from being sued for their use of violence if their actions can be justified under the law. Police officers are legally permitted to use force. Jerome Herman Skolnick writes in regards to dealing. So Jerome Skolnick is a professor at NYU and a former president of the American Society of Criminology. He is also affiliated with the University of California, Berkeley. He has a PhD in sociology from Yale. So, Mr. Skolnick writes this in regards to dealing largely with disorderly elements of the society. Some people working in law enforcement may gradually develop an attitude or sense of authority over society, particularly under traditional reaction-based policing models. In some cases, the police believe they are above the law. There are many reasons why police officers can be excessively aggressive. It is through that psychopathy that makes some officers more inclined to use excessive force than others. In one study, police psychologists surveyed officers who had used excessive force. The information obtained allowed the researchers to develop five unique types of officers, and only one of which was similar to the bad apple stereotype. So those include personality disorders, previous trauma, job-related experiences, young and inexperienced or authoritarian officers who often learn inappropriate patrol styles, and officers with personal problems. Shriver's categorized these groups and separated the group that was the most likely to use force. However, this bad apple paradigm is considered by some to be an easy way out. A broad report commissioned by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police on the causes of misconduct in policing causes a simplistic explanation that permits the organization and senior management to blame corruption on individuals and individual faults. Behavioral psychological background factors and so on, rather than addressing systemic factors. As well as the pack mentality. When you have groups of people, it is very, very, very easy to get people to go along. There's strength in numbers, even when you're talking about wrong behavior. Okay. The report continues to discuss the systemic factors, which include pressure to conform to certain aspects of police culture, such as the blue code of silence. So, let me go ahead and go into this. The blue wall of silence, also blue code and blue shield, are terms that are used to denote the supposed informal code of silence amongst police officers in the United States, not to report on a colleague's errors, misconducts, or crimes, especially as related to police brutality in the United States. If they're questioned about a incident of alleged misconduct involving another officer, especially during the course of an official inquiry, while following the code, the officer being questioned would perjure themselves by feigning ignorance of another officer's. In other words, basically no snitch for police officers. So the blue code of silence can sustain an oppositional criminal subculture protecting the interests of police who violate the law. And a we, they perspective in which officers are viewed with suspicion or distrust. Or outsiders, excuse me, are viewed with suspicion or distrust. Now, command and control structure, another factor is command and control structures with a rigid hierarchy foundation. Results indicate that the more rigid the authoritarian hierarchy, the lower the scores on a measure of ethical. Okay. The lower the scores on an ethical decision making, concludes one study involved in the report, and deficiencies on internal accountability mechanisms, including internal investigation processes. The use of force by police officers is not kept in check in many jurisdictions by the issuance of a use of force continuum, which describes levels of force considered appropriate in direct response to a suspect's behavior. This power is granted by the government with few, if any, limits set out in statutory law as well as common law. Violence used by police can be excessive despite being lawful, especially in the context of political repression. Police brutality is often used to refer to violence used by the police to achieve politically desirable ends, terrorism, and therefore none should be used at all according to widely held views. I have always wondered, like, because to me, we call the police because we want order to be brought to a situation, and many times they make the situation worse which when they're really supposed to be bringing order. Like I said to somebody once before, I always felt like their job was to de-escalate the situation, not heighten it and make it worse. And many times that's what you are seeing. So I'm going to skip down and go into global prevalence. So Amnesty International in 2007 reported on human rights, and they also documented widespread police misconduct in many other countries, especially countries with authoritarian regimes. In the UK, the reports into the death of New Zealand teacher and anti-racism campaigner Blair Peach in 1979 was published in the Metropolitan Police website on April 27, 2010. They concluded that Peach was killed by a police officer, but that the other officers in the same unit had refused to cooperate with the inquiry by lying to investigators and making it impossible to identify the actual killer. In the UN, also, Ian Tomlinson was filmed by an American tourist while he was being hit with a baton and pushed to the floor as he was walking home from work during the 2009 G20 London Summit protests. Tomlinson then collapsed and died. Though he was arrested on suspicion of manslaughter, the officer who allegedly assaulted Tomlinson was released without charge. He was later dismissed for gross misconduct. Okay, another UK incident in 2005. In 2005, a young Brazilian man was arrested and shot by Metropolitan Police in central London. The man, Jean Charles Mendes, died later. In Serbia, police brutality occurred in numerous cases during protests against Slobodan Milosevic, and has also been recorded at protests against governments since Milosevic lost power. The most recent case was recorded in July 2010 when five people, including two girls, were arrested, handcuffed, beaten with clubs, and mistreated for an hour. Security camera footage or recordings of the beating were obtained by the media, and public outrage then was released. Police officials, including Ivica Dacic, the Serbian Minister of Internal Affairs, denied this sequence of events and accused the victims to have attacked the officers first. He also publicly stated that police aren't here to beat up citizens, but that it is known that what is one going to do when attacking the police. Episodes of police brutality in India include the Rajan case, and you may want to look these up, the death of, I don't know how to pronounce that name, but if you want to look these up, they're Wikipedia, and they're lit up so you can click to go to that page. Police violence episodes against peaceful protesters appeared during the 2011 Spanish protests. Furthermore, on August 4, 2011, Gorka Ramos, a journalist of, I don't know how to pronounce this, Lane Formation, was beaten by police and arrested while covering M15 protests near the Interior Ministry in Madrid. A freelance photographer, Daniel Nuevo, was beaten by police while covering demonstrations against the Pope's visit in August 2011. In Brazil, incidents of police violence have been very well reported, and Brazil has one of the highest prevalence of police brutality in the world today. South Africa, from apartheid to today has had incidents of police brutality, though police violence is not as prevalent as during the apartheid years. There have been several incidents of police brutality toward protesters in the 2019 to 20 Hong Kong protests. So I'm going to go ahead and click on the next thing under this umbrella. Okay, I talked about Black Power. Let me see here. So I'm going to talk about the LA riots, which were so the Los Angeles riots. I'm not going to read the complete thing. If you want the complete thing, you can go to Wikipedia, because that's where all of this is coming from. So the 1992 Los Angeles riots, sometimes called the Rodney King riots or the Los Angeles Uprising of 1992, were a series of riots and civil disturbances that occurred in Los Angeles, California in April and May 1992. Unrest began in Central Los Angeles, in South Central Los Angeles, April 29th, after a jury acquitted four officers of the Los Angeles Police Department who were charged with excessive force and the arrest and beating of Rodney King. And so, so if you want to, is since deceased. They recently interviewed his daughter, and I thought it was interesting that they interviewed her, and she was talking about how, she can't believe this is still a problem. And it seems like it's gone up, but I think we're seeing a whole lot more because people are taking out their smartphones and they're recording, which I don't blame them, because now you're starting to see how prevalent it is. I knew how prevalent it was because I remember seeing people being pulled over and slammed against their cars and all of that when I would visit my aunt in Canton, Ohio. So it's everywhere. And so the incident had been videotaped. I think a white guy had caught the whole thing on camera. And so the riots occurred because many people were very discouraged that they had proof on tape and that they still let them go. And so they wound up trying them again, I believe, in civil rights court. And two of them got off and two of them didn't. I know I would like to know what evidence they were looking at that they still couldn't bring themselves. So the incident had been videotaped and shown in television broadcasts, as I said earlier. So the rioting took place in several areas in the Los Angeles metropolitan area, as thousands of people rioted over 6 days following the verdict's announcement. Widespread looting, assault, and arson occurred during the riots, which local police forces had difficulty controlling. The situation in Los Angeles was resolved only after the National Guard, United States Army, and several law enforcement agencies deployed more than 5,000 media. Now, let me say, when I saw the footage, because of course it made, the news, my heart really broke for them. It also caused me to be a little more politically involved. It also resulted in me voting in my first election. Because I'm like, the powerlessness that we feel, we need to be more involved. And I'll tell you what, our involvement kind of has gone up, to me anyway. But you start to see. Okay, and so let me talk about, so I discussed Blair Peach, so let me talk about, let me talk, go into detail. So Clement Blair Peach was born on March 25th, 1946, and died April 24th, 1979. He was a New Zealand teacher who was killed during an anti-racism demonstration in Southall, London, England. A campaigner, Lord have mercy, my English, an activist against the far right. In April 1979, Peach took part in an anti-Nazi League demonstration in South Hall against a National Front election meeting in the town hall and was hit on the head, probably by a member of the Special Patrol Group, a specialist within the Metropolitan Police Service. He died in the hospital that night. So I'm going to talk about, and I brought up globally because this seems to be a global phenomena. And it's interesting that he died as part of an anti-racism protest. So Ian Tomlinson, who was the second man that I've talked about, was a newspaper. He was born February 7, 1962, and died April 1st, 2009. He was a newspaper vendor who collapsed and died in the city of London after being struck by a police officer during the G2009 20 summit protests. After an inquest, jury returned a verdict of unlawful killing, the officer, Simon Harwood, was prosecuted for manslaughter. He was found not guilty, but was dismissed from the police service for gross misconduct. Following civil proceedings, the Metropolitan Police Service paid Tomlinson's family an undisclosed sum and acknowledged that Harwood's actions caused his death. Okay. So I brought up these other cases because sometimes you have to see that you're not alone in something that you are going through, that it's something that's being felt worldwide. A lot of people are being upset over the fact, and it seems like it is affecting people of color all around. So I'm going to return to the Black Power movement. And you may wonder how this goes into police brutality. So let me go ahead and read this for you. So Black Power is a political slogan and a name that is given to various associated ideologies which aim to achieve self-determination for Black people. It is primarily but not exclusively used by Black people, activists, and proponents of what the slogan entails in the United States. The Black Power movement was prominent in the late 60s and early 70s. It emphasized racial pride and the creation of Black political and cultural institutions to nurture, promote, and advance what was seen by proponents of the movement as being the collective interests and values of Black Americans. The basis of Black Power is The basis of Black Power's various ideologies that aim at achieving self-determination for Black people in the U.S., dictating that Black Americans create their own identities despite being subjected to pre-existing social factors. Black Power, in its original political sense, expresses a range of political goals, from militant self-defense against racial oppression to the establishment of safe social institutions and a self-sufficient economy, including Black-owned bookstores, corporations, farms, and media. However, the movement has been criticized for alienating itself from the mainstream of civil rights movement, from the mainstream civil rights movement, and its support of Black separatism. So I am not a separatist, but I do understand. So the movement was kind of birthed out of the racism that was being experienced because of police brutality. There's a book that I have on my reading list called Soul Brothers and Sister Lou. And the book talks about the attitudes of police officers when they come into largely Black areas during this time. And the book, I believe, was set in the 60s. Versus how they were in white areas. So Soul Brothers and Sister Lou, the main characters, you know, Lou, Sister Lou, were a singing group. They sang gospel music. And one of their friends was killed by the police. And so one of the things that they talked about when people would talk about the policeman, because, you know, when you're little, they have those little hokey programs where they have the police come in and they tell you that the police are your friend. And so one of the things that, you know, she basically discussed was amongst her and a lot of the Black kids, they knew better. They were not that naive because they felt like they might be y'all's friends. They ain't none of our friends. You know, I ain't met a friendly one yet. If you remember the movie West Side Story. And so West Side Story, they had, what's his name, Officer... What I can't remember, but he basically hassled because, you know, the white kids in there wasn't very wealthy white kids. They were more working class, along with Puerto Ricans. And so he pretty much hassled the white kids, but he hassled the Latin kids, the Puerto Rican kids, a whole lot worse. Like whatever they give to maybe a lower class or a white kid that's from the wrong side of the tracks, a person of color will get it a whole lot worse. So most of the good behavior is usually reserved for white people in the suburbs. Because you could be a Black person in the suburbs and still get harassed. So it's really not... So the whole Black Power thing was kind of birthed out of the fact that they were going through so much in their neighborhoods, and they made up their mind to empower themselves by, you know, establishing it. And so even though they were an offshoot of the civil rights movement, they began to distance themselves from the more nonviolent approach that was adopted by Dr. King and different ones that followed him. And I'm going to talk about the civil rights movement and the different branches, you know, because the civil rights movement is a bit of an umbrella, but then you have different... One of the things I like about the movie King, what is it, King? The latest movie that they did that was on Selma. That's the movie that I'm thinking of. So the one thing I liked about the movie Selma is that it talked about the different, like, SNCC. They had SNCC, they had CORE, the different groups that were fighting for equal rights during that time, and their different stances on what should be done to fight for those rights. Where you had some that were nonviolent, You also had some that believed in self-defense. The Black Panther Party, who was more likely to be associated with Black Power, had the notion of the, you know, being able to legally carry firearms. So they followed the Malcolm X model of being able to protect themselves, you know, and not have to deal with all of the abuse that came with the nonviolent approach. So I remember reading a book years ago when Maya Angelou, one of her, if you ever get a chance to read her memoirs. So most people know about the first one, which is I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. But there actually is a whole series of books where she talks about her adventures. So Corinne Steffens came under fire for saying that Maya Angelou was a hoe. Well, at one point she did dabble in prostitution. It didn't last long. So she's not completely lying. She led, I will say this, that's only a portion of her life, and it's a very small portion. She actually led a very, very eventful life. Had many eventful men in her life. And one of the things she talked about was her run-in with Malcolm X. And she talked about the fact that they had staged like a protest that, you know, kind of got a little out of hand. And so she went to talk to Malcolm X. And so Malcolm told her, we cannot be associated. The Nation of Islam, he was still with the Nation of Islam at the time. So he said, we would not associate with such riotous behavior. He said, but let me tell you this much. What we won't do is throw you under the bus. He said, some of your other civil rights leaders are going to turn on you quicker than Peter turned on Jesus. He said, I can promise you that we will not do that. And he kept his promise. He, you know, went ahead, even though it was not a protest that he led or was even associated with, he still managed to, you know, when he was asked publicly to speak on it, he still spoke on it in such a way that he still kind of had their backs. And so I thought that was interesting. So it's nice to, it's always good to read about, you know, not all of them had, you know, were identical. They weren't a monolith. Each had a different approach for how they felt like we should fight for our rights. So the earliest usage of the term Black Power is found in Richard Wright's book, 1954 book, Black Power. New York politician Adam Clayton Powell Jr. used the term on May 29, 1966, during an address at Howard University. And he said, to demand these God-given rights is to seek Black Power. The first popular use of the term Black Power as a political and racial slogan was by Stokely Carmichael. So we know Stokely is associated with Black Panthers. And later he changed his name to Kwame Ture. And Willie Ricks, later known as Mukasa Dada, both were organizers and spokespersons for SNCC, who I just mentioned. So SNCC stands for Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. On June 16, 1966, in a speech in Greenwood, Mississippi, after the shooting of James Meredith during the March Against Fear, Stokely Carmichael said, this is the 27th time I have been arrested, and I ain't going to jail no more. The only way we're going to stop these white men from whooping us is to take over. What we got to start saying now is Black Power. So Stokely Carmichael saw the concept of Black Power as a means of solidarity between individuals within the movement. It was a replacement of the Freedom Now slogan of Carmichael's contemporary, the nonviolence leader, Martin Luther King, or MLK as we call him, Jr. And I'm going to talk about MLK. I'm also going to talk about Malcolm X, and I'm also going to talk about the work that their children are now doing, because their children are now like in my age or older, and they are carrying the torches that their dad, that their fathers first carried. They're furthering the work. They've been passed the baton, and they're carrying. Whether or not you think the baton is being carried well, I will leave that up to your opinion. Like any family, they have suffered loss. They have gone through things within each other. So, anyway, with his use of the term, Carmichael felt this movement was not just a movement for racial desegregation, but rather a movement to help end how American racism had weakened Black people. He said Black power means Black people coming together to form a political force and either electing representatives or forcing their representatives to address their needs. Carmichael and Charles V. Hamilton explained the term Black power in their 1967 book, Black Power, The Politics of Liberation. It is a call for Black people in this country to unite, to recognize their heritage, to build a sense of community. It is a call for people to define their own goals and to lead their own organizations. So I'm going to go ahead and this portion of this podcast on this note. So whether or not you feel empowered after what I just read and everything, Black powered police brutality was more or less the kickoff for the Black power movement, because it came after, you know, being, let me look here again. So let's go into James Meredith here. So James Meredith, James Howard Meredith is an American civil rights activist, writer, political advisor, and Air Force veteran who became in 1962 the first African American student to be admitted to the racially segregated University of Mississippi after the intervention of the federal government. Okay, so he wanted to highlight continued racism. So he planned a solo. Let me start again. So I read his credentials, but he was the first African American student to be admitted to the racially segregated University of Mississippi after the intervention of the federal government, an event that was a flashpoint in the civil rights movement. Inspired by President John F. Kennedy's inaugural speech, Mr. Meredith decided to exercise his constitutional rights and apply to the University of Mississippi. His goal was to put pressure on the Kennedy administration to enforce civil rights for African Americans. So in 1966, he planned a solo 220-mile march against fear from Memphis, Tennessee to Jackson, Mississippi. He wanted to highlight continued racism in the South and encourage voter registration after passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. He did not want major civil rights organizations involved. The second day, he was shot by a white gunman and suffered numerous wounds. Leaders of major organizations vowed to complete the march in his name after he was taken to the hospital. While he was recovering, more people from across the country became involved as marchers. He rejoined the march, and when he and other leaders entered Jackson on June 26th, they were leading an estimated 15,000 marchers. In what was the largest civil rights march in Mississippi. During the march, more than 4,000 African Americans registered to vote, and it was a catalyst to continued community organizing and additional registration. In 2002, and again in 2012, the University of Mississippi led year-long series of events to celebrate the 40th and 50th anniversary of Meredith's integration of the institution. He was amongst several numerous speakers invited to the campus, where a statue of him commemorates his role. The Lyceum, the Circle Historic District at the center of the campus, has been designated as a National Historic Landmark for So as you can see, they used what they were going through to kick off the Black Power movement. So like I said, I will be doing another episode after this episode, but I want to end on this note. Read about these figures. If you are African American, like, I'm not going to quit this. Read nonfiction works about your history, but works of fiction that even mention your history. You have a very, very illustrious history here and abroad. So I'm going to go ahead and get off here. Enjoy the rest of your day, wherever you're listening to this podcast from. And I will be going into another topic. Let me look and see what the next topic is going to be. What I'm going to go into next. It's either going to be the psychology of racism, or I may go into Black nationalism. I think I may go into Black nationalism and go into its roots. It has very illustrious. I'm not just going to be talking about civil rights and different other stuff. I also want to go into figures who preceded the civil rights movement and kind of helped kick it off. Because figures like Earl Little, Malcolm X's dad, Martin Luther King Sr., MLK Jr.'s father, Marcus Garvey, who was responsible for the Pan-African movement, the Back to Africa movement. And so I hope to make this whole thing very interesting for you. And I hope that you enjoy listening to this podcast. So I will talk with you guys later. That is the sound of me giving you a kiss goodbye. And I will talk with you, and I will see you on the next podcast.